This is EdUp Legal with your host, Deborah Solmore. She's an experienced higher education lawyer, most recently the general counsel for a system of nonprofit institutions, and she's going to be leading conversations about trending legal, regulatory, and compliance matters in higher education, with a focus on leaving out the legalese and making legal easy. Let's hear from your host, Deborah Solmore.
Welcome to another episode of the EdUp Experience Legal Podcast. Today, I am fortunate to have as my guests two partners at the law firm of Thompson Coburn, Scott Goldschmidt and Jeff Fink. Welcome. It's nice to have you here.
Thank you, Deborah. Good to be here.
Thank you, Deborah. Yeah, absolutely happy to be here.
So today, I guess I want to set the stage by saying that it seems to me like in late spring, early summer, every time I turned on the news or I checked my online news source, I was going to say picked up a newspaper, but I don't think many people pick up a newspaper anymore. Someone was talking about student loan payments, debt forgiveness. We had the Supreme Court invalidate President Biden's loan forgiveness plan. Most student loan payments have been on a reprieve since March of 2020 due to the COVID-19 pandemic, and they are scheduled to start up again in October. So I think I just kept seeing things related to student loan forgiveness and debt forgiveness. As we head into the fall now, the last few weeks, I know that many institutions have been receiving letters from the Department of Education telling them that they have what we refer to as borrower defense claims or defense to repayment claims pending against them, and they should be responding. So I'm excited to have you both on here to talk about what are these BDR claims, why are schools getting these notices, and what does this all mean? So that's where I want to start. And I was hoping that one of you might be able to explain to our listeners, what is a borrower defense to repayment claim?
Sure. Well, Deborah, a borrower defense to repayment claim is a claim by a federal student loan borrower for their federal student loans while attending school that they were somehow lied to, deceived, cheated by their schools, or their schools didn't fulfill their promises. And as a result, they believe that these students believe they should be able to get out of their loans, avoid responsibility, and also recoup any payments they've made on the loans. This is an area that is of questionable authority for the department to do. The statutes don't seem to specifically allow for this, but nevertheless, the department is going forward with it as part of its overall effort to provide loan forgiveness, rightly or wrongly. And so through these claims, ostensibly, the department is supposed to be looking into and seeing whether students were misled or cheated by their schools. And we had a big pause in this over the last administration. There was litigation over it. That litigation resulted in a settlement that turns out to be very, very favorable to students. And now the department is finally getting around to implementing it.
And historically, the authority, rightly or wrongly, for these borrower defense claims is pretty old. It's been around since, what I would say, the early 90s. Why is this something suddenly, what's the history of how this sort of exploded? Where did this come from, this whole rash of these claims? Because my understanding is there's hundreds of thousands of these claims pending at the Department of Education.
Yeah, that's right. A lot of traditional schools have been seeing these claims and are surprised to learn the history dates back to about 1993, when Congress introduced the BDR concept and really directed the Department of Education to specify in regulations acts or omissions of a higher education institution that you could assert a borrower defense claim. Now, from 1993 until about 2015, the statute kind of gathered dust. There wasn't really much to do. It was used a few times. But in 2015, listeners who remember, that's about when the Corinthian and ITT Tech institutions kind of imploded. And so there was a rash of these borrower defense claims. The Obama administration picked up the mantle and created a fairly complex process in 2016 through negotiated rulemaking that really expanded the borrower defense process and how to create claims and adjudicate claims. The Trump administration then again saw what happened with the Obama administration, didn't really like those regulations, implemented their own version of a borrower defense to repayment process during that administration. And the Biden administration then didn't like what the Trump administration did and decided to again revise the rules. And I know we're going to talk about the Fifth Circuit kind of injunction soon, but just to get to your question about why we're seeing these claims, I think there are two reasons, right? And the first one's the one that Jeff alluded to. In the Sweet settlement, the department is legally obligated to adjudicate certain claims in certain time periods. So any claim filed or pending before June 22nd, 2022, there is a schedule that the department has legally agreed to where they have to respond to these claims under a very streamlined, very favorable process. And if they don't get to the claims in that expedited timeline, the borrower gets full relief. There's actually another kind of group of people that if you filed a claim before November 15th, 2022, there is another timeline where the department is legally obligated to kind of provide those claims. So the first reason we think we're seeing a lot of these claims is the Sweet settlement obligates the department to do it, and kind of that's why schools are getting it. The second piece is, I think, Deborah, what you alluded to in the beginning of your talk, is a lot of the Biden administration's priorities. This is directly from their mouth and is part of this podcast. I went and looked at their press releases, and in big bold letters, this is their language, they say they're trying to get debt relief for as many borrowers as possible, as fast as possible. So borrower defense or repayment is one of the avenues to achieve this goal politically, to try and get debt relief to as many borrowers as possible, as fast as possible. And if you look at the department's websites, they're really trumpeting the fact that they've forgiven a lot of claims under this borrower defense process, and are really trying to make it as easy as they can for students, for borrowers, to file these claims. And this also goes along with the loan forgiveness piece, part and parcel of it, along with the Supreme Court struck down the Biden one-time forgiveness process. But the day it was struck down, they came out with a negotiated rulemaking where the department's going to use its compromise and settlement authority under the Higher Education Act to accomplish much the same purposes. And that negotiated rulemaking is underway and should be really gearing up this fall and into next year. The department has also implemented the SAVE plan, which is a brand new loan forgiveness or loan repayment program. Part of the idea there is borrowers would pay the least amount of their loans kind of in history and kind of be able to pay there. And also a lot of closed school loan discharge processes. So if a school does go out of business, does close, the department can discharge loans and has done that and has made a lot of a press out of that process. So all those things are the political kind of ways that the Biden administration really is seeking to implement this debt forgiveness.
I think that's a great overview because, as you said, there are a lot of moving pieces under the umbrella of loan forgiveness. And actually, the first episode of the podcast when I took over was actually a discussion about loan forgiveness before the Supreme Court's decision. I want to, I think, break down a couple of the things that you both said. So, Jeff, you alluded to this settlement that is the impetus maybe for these letters that institutions are getting. And Scott, you gave it a name, you called it the Sweet settlement. And in my being true to my mantra of keeping legal easy, I want to make clear that the Sweet settlement is named the Sweet settlement, not as an adjective about what kind of settlement it is, but because the plaintiff in the case last name was Sweet, and we lawyers generally refer to things by names of certain people in the litigation. So the Sweet settlement refers to a lawsuit where the named plaintiff had the last name of Sweet. And I know we could talk about this for days and we don't have all day, but maybe just a quick overview of what were the allegations in the Sweet case that led to this settlement. And as you both explained, I think very well, this settlement sets up a rubric by which the Department of Education has agreed to process certain borrower defense claims.
Sure.
And what prompted the litigation in the first place?
Well, sure. And the Sweet lawsuit started because under the Trump administration, the Department of Education was effectively just not processing BDR applications at all. And so you had these student debt relief organizations out there who are frustrated by the delay, by what they believe was stonewalling by the Trump administration. And so they filed the lawsuit out in California to force the department to act. That's all they were asking for. Just give us a decision. And then that proceeded along for a while. The department at one point did process some, but they typically were just denying applications at a high rate. And so there was a thought that the department was not acting in good faith and was not really processing these according to what some people believe they should have been doing. And so then the lawsuit morphed from not only being, hey, just make a decision on our applications. That's all we're asking for, because there was a huge backlog. It was no longer just make a decision. Hey, you need to grant them because you've taken so long to do it. You should be, you, the department, should be penalized. You should just grant these borrower applications and discharge the loans. And ultimately, that's what happened through the settlement. The initial settlement that was proposed to the court was just to have the department get off its duff and decide the applications. That was rejected ultimately, and they had to go back to the drawing board. And then the second round of settlement talk was, no, let's just grant these en masse. And so what you ended up with was a settlement where if you were one of the students who went to the proverbial blacklist of 300 schools, you were going to automatically get grant your application granted. But beyond that, even if you weren't at one of those schools, if you were at any other school and you filed your application before a certain deadline, before June 23 of 2022, your application effectively is going to be granted under a streamlined process where all you have to do is just say, I was cheated or deceived by my school. You don't have to submit any evidence. It appears that the department is not even going to invite the schools to respond to those complaints. But instead, just long as the borrower had enough sense to fill out the application correctly, the department's going to grant it. And that's how we ended up with the settlement. So we started off from a case was just about get the department to make decisions, to a settlement where the department's automatically granting relief to presumably tens, if not hundreds of thousands of students.
And I know I'd like to get to practical guidance for what institutions who are receiving these notices should be thinking about. But I think it bears noting that this litigation was initially between one of these borrower defense sort of student rights groups and the Department of Education. None of the schools were involved. So none of the schools were there to basically say, oh, no, don't grant my borrower defense applications, or wait a second, these allegations that I defrauded my students, I want to show you that this is not the case. And so I think somehow that sometimes gets lost when we talk about the Sweet settlement, that it was really negotiated for the most part between a student rights group and the Department of Education with no input initially from any of the schools.
Well, that's right. The schools had absolutely no say in any of this. And in fact, they tried to get involved after the settlement was trying to be rammed through the court and get the court's blessing, because the court ultimately had to approve any settlement. The only people proposing the settlement were the student debt relief organizations and the Department of Education, which was effectively on the side of the student debt relief organizations, and it was just rolling over and willing to give whatever they wanted. It was only when the settlement was announced that some schools tried to get involved, tried to go to the court and object and say, hey, this isn't fair, this isn't right. Ultimately, they were unsuccessful, but there were a few schools that tried to champion the cause. Like I said, in the end, they were unsuccessful, and the courts effectively are just going to let the department roll over and do what it wants in this area.
One of the reasons I think that this podcast or this topic is so important, and I wanted to bring it to listeners, is because, and I think, Scott, you mentioned this when you were sort of giving the historical perspective, that these borrower defense claims really ratcheted up and started to overwhelm the department in the 2015, 2016, 17 range with the collapse of some of what people refer to as either the for-profit or the proprietary education institutions. And I think a lot of the more traditional schools and the public schools thought, this doesn't impact me. This is not my problem. And one of the reasons that I wanted to bring this is because from what we've discussed, and also what I've discussed with some of my other outside counsel and in-house colleagues, is that this is very much not a quote unquote for-profit school problem anymore. And that there are numerous publics and more traditional privates that are in this group of institutions that are getting these notices. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And there was a Department of Education responded to a FOIA request in 2022. That's the latest data that we have. And kind of looking through the list of schools, it's most Title IV eligible schools. And that the most schools are traditional nonprofit public schools have at least some claims, right? So they have a handful, 10 or so, and the bigger schools have more claims. This is absolutely not just a for-profit issue anymore, for sure. I absolutely agree with that. And I think part of the kind of the wake-up call, if you look at the listserv, NACUA listservs and things like that, it's a lot of institutions and general counsels starting to be aware that this is out there. How do we respond to this, and kind of what do we do?
And I think we'll move into that. And I just want to sort of tie up everything that we're talking about. So for these institutions, to the extent you are being notified, you have borrower defense claims pending against you, what those claims are, and I think you both eloquently explained this, are claims that students are making saying that you somehow defrauded them, that somehow the institution committed fraud or made misrepresentations to them. And so I think this is something that institutions should be taking seriously from a reputational perspective, and that this rubric that the Department of Education has created has sort of taken on a life of its own, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, a couple points on that. I sure agree. Reputation is a huge impact there. I mean, I think there's a lot of reasons schools should take this as seriously. In addition to reputation, it's the possible, and we'll do talk about, I think, how likely a recoupment action is, but it is possible the secretary has the authority to go after institutions for any discharges and kind of require schools to go through this process and potentially pay claims. But the department is also kind of using just the existence of borrower defense claims as part of other pieces of their regulatory structure, as part of the new and financial responsibility rules. Just the fact that you have a borrower defense claim or a certain borrower defense claims could be enough for the department to take action against you, to kind of have higher authority and oversight and things like that. So even not corroborated claims could be potentially there. Part of the department's new change in rules too is just the fact that you have multiple kind of claims could be kind of self-fulfilling. So the department could use potential claims that they approved as evidence that there is a systemic issue at your school, and kind of even without necessarily input from the institution, take other actions and kind of go down from there. So it's not just would this particular borrower defense claim cause any issue. It could have a cascading effect to other parts of the institution, as well as the reputation.
That's a great segue into my next topic. And thank you for giving me another idea for a future podcast episode. So your firm, you and your colleagues, wrote a wonderful piece on practical guidelines for how to think about responding to them. And I will link that in the show notes. I know you have a bunch of webinars that I will also link, sort of giving guidance on what are these borrower defense claims. But in the short time that we have left, it would be really great if you could give an overview of what should schools that are receiving these notices from the department really be thinking about. And I love the article that you wrote, because you put it sort of in buckets and categories and very well organized. So if you want to just provide us with an overview of, I get one of these notices, what should I be doing with it? Sure. Calling my lawyers, I get that. But after that, after I've picked up the phone and called you.
Well, I think, Deborah, what you want to do when you get one of these notices is you want to read over it and see what the student is alleging. I think you definitely want to respond to these, because if you don't respond to them, the department is going to think it's even more justified in granting the student the relief he or she is seeking. At least if you file an opposition, hopefully the department will think twice before granting. Now, it may not make a difference ultimately, but I think you have to assume it's in your best interest to do so and to file an opposition. When you do your opposition, these allegations presumably are going to be untrue. And you just need to be upfront with the department in a written response and say, these are untrue. I would go allegation by allegation, say, student alleges X, that's not true. How do we know that? Because here are documents that show it's untrue. We've got maybe the enrollment agreement. We may have a school catalog, a student handbook. Ideally, if the employees who dealt with that student are still around, maybe you get an affidavit from them saying, no, I never promised them a job, or I never told them that their credits would transfer to other schools. And you try to at least build the best evidentiary record that you can to show that these student allegations are simply untrue and the student is not entitled to any relief. And from a, you know, big picture, that's what you got to do, I think, is respond, find whatever evidence you can muster to show the student's allegations are untrue. And then you might also in their protest too, the whole procedure, and say, this is unfair. This is a violation of due process. The idea is just to get back there and make it give the department something to think about and say, well, you know, maybe I shouldn't be granting the student because this institution, this school is not going to roll over and take it lightly. They're going to fight this. And they've got, and by the way, they've got evidence because these student complaints typically have zero evidence with them. It's just the student signing stuff. And a lot of times there's inconsistencies even within their own application, things that make no sense and undermine what they claim. On the other hand, the institution will have documents typically and evidence to refute these allegations. And I think it's in the school's interest to muster that together, put it in a good response and send it back to the department and see where it goes from there.
I absolutely agree with Jeff. I would just add too, that, I mean, I think there's some value, as we mentioned, like the department's going to make their decision, we'll do the best we can with our evidence, but there's some value in kind of sticking in some legal arguments to potentially preserve defenses if it does go to an additional process. And also just alert the department that you understand what the standards are. As we talked about, there's three different buckets that these claims can be adjudicated under, and each have different standards in terms of what the definition of misrepresentation is, the time limits, everything like that. So a student complaint or defense from 2014 would be adjudicated under the 1994 standards. One from 2018 would be adjudicated under the 2017 standards, and et cetera. So just kind of making sure that not only do you, I think Jeff's exactly right, the most important point is that you really just kind of show, here's the factual defense, here's the reason why this claim has no merit, but also the legal piece of this doesn't even state a proper claim under the applicable standard. The statute of limitations has run. The process is just, we don't have any process here. It's unconstitutional. It's not fair. All those things I think have value. Hopefully you never have to deal with it again, but if you do, just to kind of show that you were always consistent in your arguments, you raised it at the first possible time, there's no argument you waived a defense.
I think two things that you both talked about maybe bear mentioning. The first is that there are multiple versions of these borrower defense regulations. So there's pre-2016, there's the 2016 version, there's the 2020 version. At some point, maybe there'll be the new version they're trying to enact now. So what I would say, sort of in my putting on my, well, I have two wonderful outside lawyers, I'll put on my general counsel hat, which is read the rules, know the regulations. And if you don't have the team, or you don't have the staff, or you don't have the time and the resources to really dig into the regulations, that's where your outside counsel comes in really handy, because this is not a very short, I mean, if you look at the Federal Register for these rules, it's overwhelming. And since the various versions differ, it is, I think you make a very good point. It is understanding which version of the rules you need to be under. So I think that's a great point. And the second thing that sort of came out of what you were talking about that maybe you want to sort of elaborate on a little, if you're not familiar with these claims, the way the claims get filed have sort of changed over the years. But in essence, the department created its own form. You want to file a borrower defense claim, here's the form you fill out. And I will let you take it away from here, but the form is very easy to fill out. You don't need a whole lot. So talk a little bit about that so schools understand, well, why does the form look the way it does? Why is what I'm getting when the department sends these claims to me not necessarily very robust or very detailed?
Well, funny thing is, Deborah, is there have been multiple versions of the complaint form that students can fill out. And that complaint form has been either easier, very pro easy for students to fill out under the Obama and the Biden administrations, whereas students had to do a little bit more work with the form used under the Trump administration. The form currently being used is so bad that it basically just invites students to make allegations against their school. It's almost like all you have to do is check a box. And like here, this one, I'll read you this one we have. It says the box, and you can check it. My school did not fulfill its guarantee that I would find future employment. Well, that box itself assumes that the school made such a guarantee in the first place. And it's almost like suggesting to the student, well, my school must have guaranteed employment. Hey, I didn't couldn't find employment. So, hey, school breached that. I want my loans discharged. And that goes on throughout here, where these boxes that you can just check are so loaded against the school that it's easy for the students to check them. Now, the student is supposed to, after they check those boxes, kind of elaborate on it. But I'm guessing the department's not going to require a whole lot of elaboration on this complaint form. All they have to do is check some boxes, just put in a few buzzwords, and I think there they go. And that's what you, and in essence, that's what you have to respond to as a school. When you see this, you come in, you say, wait a minute, where is this coming from? Well, I'm guessing the debt collective organizations have worked with the Department of Education to come up with these forms to make it as easy as possible for students to claim that they were cheated or defrauded by their schools, and to make it so it looks like it's justified for the department to grant discharges.
And I can tell you, over my decade of higher ed practice, I have seen a number of the borrower defense claim forms. And I agree with you. Many of them have no explanation, no details. So I guess the last place that I want to go, I could talk to you all day about this, but the last place I want to go is explaining for institutions, this is really a two-phase process. And what we have spent most of our time talking about is, what do you do when you're being asked to respond to these claims for the purpose of the department adjudicating them? In other words, deciding whether the borrower is or is not entitled to debt forgiveness. And I think one of the reasons that your advice is so great and it's so important to respond really also goes to part two of the process, which is that the regulations provide an avenue for the department to try and recoup any money that they discharge from students at your school against the institution. So maybe talk a little bit about that in the context of while you're thinking about how to respond to them, what could happen later?
Yeah, that's a great point, Deborah. And I think this is really, I guess, institutions we've been speaking to didn't really understand this piece either. So I think really important to cover. So the piece we've been talking about is, right, this, the department gets the application, sends it to the school, and allows the school to respond. So this is the kind of the part A piece. That is heard by a department official. So heard, read, the application and your response is read by a department official. Presumably, hopefully, the department official will review it against applicable legal standards and make a determination. So the determination, kind of depending on the applicable standard, could be anything from full relief to if it was a breach of contract action based on the contract or something like that. But the department will make their determination. That piece of the process is between the department and the student. The school is tangentially involved as you're provided some information, you're at the opportunity to provide your piece and say, have your bite at the apple, but it's not much. There's no process for the institution. There's no back and forth. There's no chance to present things or kind of go to the department to answer questions. It's just really the department reaching out. And the theory there from the department's angle is, this is the department's process. We hold the loans. We're just trying to determine if we have enough evidence to discharge it in accordance with our regulations. That full stop. After that, the process could end. Even if full discharge is given, the school might never hear of it again, and everyone goes on their merry way. But it's important to note the secretary, as you mentioned, Deborah, does have the option to initiate a recoupment process. And again, depending on the standard, you're in different parts of the regulations in terms of what process is provided, subpart G versus subpart H. One part is more favorable to the department, one part is more favorable to the institution. It depends on what administration you're going from. But suffice it to say, subpart G and subpart H both provide process for the institution. There is a traditional kind of opportunity to be heard, present evidence, kind of a neutral arbiter, kind of look at all the decisions and kind of made. So that process is there for a recoupment action. The department could not ask the school, and by recoupment, I mean having the school end up having to
reimburse
for the funds that were discharged. So the institution would not be on the hook for a recoupment action until an administrative law judge under these department processes make it a formal determination. All appeal rights to the secretary were exhausted. And even after that, there's kind of an option to appeal to federal court. So it is a just important to know, and I guess the question is out there, kind of how much the department is going to go to the second recoupment part of their process. But the piece that we're focusing on now is just part A. And then part B is a much more intensive process because real dollars are involved for institutions.
And then I'll throw out sort of one question to connect A and B. What do you say to schools who say, well, I got this notice, I don't really want to participate in part A. If the department wants to grant money to students, that's fine. I'm going to sit back and wait and see if part B becomes a reality, if they come and try to recoup money from me. Is there a waiver? Can you not participate in B if you didn't participate in A? Well, how should institutions be thinking about that?
Well, I think the risk you have is that if you don't participate, you know, you don't have to participate in part A. And if the department grants a discharge and they come after your school, try to get reimbursed for any amount they discharge, you'll have a right at that point to contest it. You'd have an appeal before the Office of Hearings and Appeals within the department. However, I think if you take the time up front, resist the borrower defense complaint, explain to the department why it's bogus, that it should not be granted, show the evidence that you've done your homework, I think you really will enhance your possibilities that you'll never see a Part B proceeding against you in the first place. So I think if you invest a little bit of time up front, I think that'll go a long way to saving you a lot of trouble in the future.
I think that's great advice. And I will end there, except to ask each one of you if you have any sort of last minute practical advice or last minute guidance you want to throw out before we end.
I'm happy to start. I know we alluded to this, and I just wanted to be clear. This is a question we get from institutions kind of on these calls. They've heard about this Fifth Circuit decision out there. So I just want to kind of clear.
You did mention it and I didn't follow up. So thank you.
No problem.
I'll pass the mic to you. Yes. Tell us about
really,
where the
really briefly. Yeah. On that, the Fifth Circuit, as many of you heard, filed an injunction on borrower defense rules. One of the first questions we get from clients reviewing this is, does this mean the whole process is stayed? Do we have to do anything else? The takeaway here is the Fifth Circuit injunction only enjoins the Biden administration's version of the borrower defense rules. So as we talked about, there's a 1994 version, a 2016 version, a 2019 version. They don't replace each other. So they're all kind of, they're in effect in various forms. And so the 2019 version of the borrower defense rules is still in effect. That's what the department kind of would be using until the Fifth Circuit decision is eventually figured out. So worth following, worth being aware of, but doesn't mean schools are off the hook to kind of get this repaid or get the borrower defense process there. In terms of practical advice, just treat it seriously. And as Jeff said, I think these are not rocket science to fill out. It gets a little complicated with the standards and applicable rules and kind of defenses, but really at base, hopefully it's just something that your institution can kind of factually refute fairly easily. So take the time to do it. And hopefully that'll save you a lot of heartache before.
Right. And so when you talk about the Fifth Circuit, you're talking about the Biden administration's versions of the borrower defense regulations that were scheduled to go into effect on July 1st. And someone challenged them and said they shouldn't become effective. And what the Fifth Circuit, which is an appellate court, said is, hold off. We need to really look at this. And until we look at this, these regulations are not going to go into effect, which gets back to your point that the 2019 ones are still the ones you look at. I think I called them 2020 before, but the 2019 ones. Okay. All right, 100%. Jeff, what about you?
Yeah, I would think that, you know, even though we have the litigation against the current borrower defense regulations, everyone has to assume that borrower defense is here to stay. And really the differences between the regulations are just a matter of nuance and really are going to be driven by who is in charge of the Department of Education. Because in the end, if the department wants to grant a borrower defense claim, it can do so whether it applies the Obama regulation, the Trump regulation, or the Biden regulation. And so given that, you just have to take it seriously, I believe, and assume that you're in an unfavorable environment in terms of borrower defense. And in this current environment, it behooves you to take it seriously, these complaints, and respond to them. And that, I think in the end, that'll be in your best interest to try to avoid any liability to the department.
Well, I thank you both for coming on. This has been an engaging and fair warning. If you're still listening, you'll know that I went past my general 20 minutes, but this was just so interesting. And again, and thank you for the resource that the firm put together. Your blog is wonderful. There's always great information on there on anything higher ed related. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And I invite everybody to check out your blog and to basically pay serious attention to these notices if you're getting them. So Scott, Jeff, thank you very much. I hope you enjoyed your stint on the EdUp Legal Experience podcast.
Well, thank you, Deborah. We appreciate the opportunity to chat with you today.
Yes, thank you, Deborah.